The readings we heard this morning from Daniel and Mark are among those end of times readings that Father Randall told us last week we could expect to hear during Advent. If I were attending service in the church of my youth, I might hear a preacher declare that the end was near, that all of the signs that were supposed to happen have happened, and that we were living on borrowed time, and then asking us if we were ready for the final judgment. All of that is not what these readings are about, as we have heard many times. Such a literal reading of the text can give rise to a view of God that is narrow, impoverished, fear-based. It can obscure the radical nature of God's self-revelation to communities of real people in very different social, economic, historical, and cultural contexts. The passages we heard from Daniel and Mark were written at a time when faithful Jews and faithful Christians, respectively, were threatened with danger. The verses we heard from Daniel end a series of visions through which Daniel learned that the area in which he lived was going to fall under several different empires. The Syrian Greek ruler that ruled over Jerusalem at the time was trying to force Jews to stop practicing the law and to become Greekish. So the ultimate message to that community was the one that we heard today, that even through the terrible sufferings law-abiding Jews were experiencing, God was faithful, God was watchful, and God would rescue them. It expresses the same kind of confidence that we sang about in today's responsorial psalm. The Lord upholds our lot. The Lord gives us counsel. The Lord will not abandon us to the grave, and the Lord will show us the path of life. The Gospel of Mark was similarly written in challenging times. It's thought to have been written in the 60s of the Common Era, when Jewish and Gentile Christians were facing persecution in Rome, and they feared that a looming revolt in Palestine would only make matters worse. This is the context for the reading from Mark that we heard today. The section we heard begins with an unnamed disciple commenting on the size and splendor of the temple, and he wasn't kidding. Herod had expanded the temple on a vast and lavish scale, and the temple complex was massive. It could hold more than 12 football fields and tens of thousands of people. The outer walls were made of blocks, some of which weighed more than 2 tons. So when Jesus says, "Not one stone will be left on top of another," you can imagine how difficult this might have been to hear, how startling it might have been to think that such a massive symbol of Jewish identity would be completely destroyed, and how frightening it must have been to wonder about the event that would wreak such havoc. Next, we see Jesus sitting on the Mount of Olives with the inner circle of disciples, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, asking, "When will this be?" And Jesus gives 2 pieces of advice. First, he tells them to beware that no one deceives them, that many will come falsely claiming to be him, but they shouldn't be deceived, they shouldn't go following after these people. Second, he told them not to be alarmed when they heard about wars and rumors of war, about distressing things and distressing events, but things that didn't quite touch them yet. Now, scholars speculate about the exact historical events Jesus was referencing, but many agree that the ultimate message for first century followers, as well as for us today, is don't be distracted from the movement by distressing events. In other words, stay the course. Staying the course can be tough in the best of times, but it can be especially difficult during times of stress, chaos, loss, dislocation, or other challenges. And it doesn't really matter whether we have brought the woes on ourselves or they've been caused by circumstances beyond our influence. They're still distressing. Jesus tells us what we should do, stay the course, but not necessarily how to do it. So I started to wonder, are there any techniques or practices that could help us stay the course, that could help us weather adversity and discord while growing in compassion and service to others, as we're called to do by the gospel? And what I discovered was the concept of self-compassion. And when I say I discovered it, I didn't invent this. This is a thing. There are books and research articles, and to let you know it's truly official, I think there might be a YouTube video as well. It's a thing. So we talk about compassion as sensitivity to the experience of the suffering of others, coupled with a desire to relieve that suffering. And there's also a wisdom component, because we know that lasting relief from suffering requires recognizing the interconnected causes and conditions that make us suffer. That's where practicing self-compassion comes in. Self-compassion is a frame of mind cultivated by the interplay of three things: mindfulness, self-kindness, and recognizing our common humanity. Teachers of spirituality across the board encourage us to be mindful, to be self-aware, to be here when we are here and not be somewhere else. An ancient tale from another tradition tells it this way. A disciple asked the teacher, "Where shall I look for enlightenment?" "Here," the teacher said. "When will it happen?" the student asked. "It's happening right now," said the teacher. "Then why don't I experience it?" "Because you do not look," the teacher said. "What should I look for?" "Nothing," the teacher said. "Just look." "At what?" "Anything your eyes light upon," said the teacher. "Well, must I look in a special way?" "No," the teacher said. "The ordinary way will do." "But don't I always look in the ordinary way?" "No," the teacher replied, "you don't." "Why ever not?" demanded the disciple. "Because to look, you must be here," the teacher said. "You're mostly somewhere else." "We're mostly somewhere else. We're very skilled at multitasking and operating on automatic pilot to get through our very busy days, but that comes at a cost sometimes. Oftentimes, when we are here, we're still thinking about what happened at the place we came from, or already thinking about what we're going to do when we go to the place that we go to when we leave here." Anthony DeMello, a Jesuit priest from India who had a very eclectic approach to spirituality, said, "Be aware of what you are saying. Be aware of what you are doing. Be aware of what you are thinking. Be aware of how you are acting." Being aware means being open to the reality of the present moment, observing our thoughts, emotions, and sensations. I had a teacher who used to say we should always be the first hearer of our words. But when we observe our thoughts, emotions, our sensations, and our words, we do so without resistance, without avoidance, without judgment. And that's where self-kindness comes in. We're pretty good at being kind to others. When a spouse, a child, a loved one, a coworker, even a stranger makes a mistake, says something embarrassing, and really starts to take it out personally on themselves, to blame themselves or to doubt their competence, we usually don't try to be agreeable at that moment. We don't say, "Yes, you are a loser. You are a dimwit." That's not the time that we agree with people. We assure them that they're not. They're not losers. They're not failures. They're not dimwits. They just made a mistake. They miscalculated. The result happened because of things beyond their control. We let them know it's okay to fail. We assure them of our respect and support when they're feeling bad about themselves, and we comfort them when they're going through hard times. We do not often extend the same level of compassion on a consistent basis to ourselves. When we fail at something or become angry yet again, despite our best efforts not to be angry, or find ourselves worrying about something or feel stressed out, we are hard on ourselves. We tear ourselves down. Rather than simply acknowledge that we failed, we label ourselves as a failure. Rather than simply acknowledge that we said something that wasn't appropriate, we call ourselves stupid. We blame ourselves for getting angry, or we blame someone else for making us angry, rather than look at the reasons why we got angry, acknowledging it and looking at those reasons why. And when we observe ourselves worrying or become anxious, we label ourselves a worrier or incompetent or not up to the task. Self-kindness counters these tendencies so that we are as caring toward ourselves as we are toward others. Rather than being harshly critical of ourselves when noticing our own personal shortcomings, we can be supportive and encouraging. Instead of attacking and berating ourselves, we can offer ourselves warmth and unconditional acceptance. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we excuse conduct we know to be unacceptable or that we don't apologize when we know that we have hurt someone. I'm simply saying that when life's circumstances are challenging and difficult to bear, we extend to ourselves the same kind of compassion we so readily show others. The season of Advent is a perfect time to practice the mindfulness and self-kindness of self-compassion because it's a time of waiting. The waiting of Advent, though, is not passive. It's an active waiting, a waiting in anticipation. Active waiting means to be fully present in the moment because you know that something is happening where you are and you want to be present to it. Active waiting is patient waiting. We're willing to stay where we are and live the situation out to the full in the belief that something hidden there will be manifest to us. This kind of patient waiting is the same spirit in which we practice mindfulness with self-kindness. The season of Advent is also the perfect season to practice self-compassion because we know what we're waiting for. What we're looking forward to isn't a secret. We are again anticipating the event that made it possible for us to participate humanly in the divine. We are looking for the birth of the one who became human so that we might become divine. Tell that to your self-critic. So as we practice self-compassion, we can counter that inner critic that tries to apply derogatory labels to us. We can counter that with an affirmation of faith that through Christ, we are humanly divine. We participate in the divine in a human way. The third component of self-compassion is recognizing our common humanity. This is where it all comes together. Recognizing our deep and fundamental interconnectedness is central to self-compassion. Henry Nouwen wrote, "To pray, that is, to listen to the voice of the one who calls us the beloved, is to learn that that voice excludes no one. Where I dwell, God dwells with me. And where God dwells with me, I find all my sisters and brothers. And so intimacy with God and solidarity with all people are two aspects of dwelling in the present moment that can never be separated." Let me say that last thing again because it's important. And so intimacy with God and solidarity with all people are two aspects of dwelling in the present moment that can never be separated. When we remember that pain, fear, and misfortune, as well as joy, love, and grace, and the capacity for divinization are parts of our shared human experience, every human experience is transformed into a moment of connection with other people. Far from leading us into self-indulgence or self-centeredness, the practice of self-compassion is a spirituality for the long haul. It has the potential to open us up to the world in a way that helps us love our neighbors as ourselves and to compel us to relate to and serve others out of a deep love and compassion. We will experience tough times. There will be distress in our world, in our communities, in our families, in our lives. We don't need to avoid it, nor should we. Jesus tells us to stay the course, to be aware, undeceived, unalarmed, essentially to trust radically. One way of doing this is to develop the practice of self-compassion, to be mindful of our words, actions, thoughts, to be kind and tender with ourselves, to know that we are deeply and fundamentally interconnected, and to recognize that all of us have the capacity for participation in the divine. Let us make this Advent season a time when we remember those things, when we remember to give ourselves the same compassion that we freely give to others, a time to remember that our interconnectedness is far more fundamental than our differences, than our divisions, and a time to face our world in the knowledge that all of us have the capacity for the God life now. Amen.